pals, who was not entirely in control of his feelings, rolled his eyes like a hunted animal, and looked at me, shaking his head. Maybe we shouldn't stop to eat. If an officer came along. A deafening salvo which seemed to be passing right over our heads interrupted us, and we instinctively hunched our shoulders and shut our eyes. Hals was about to speak again when another explosion, different in kind, but no less brutal, shook the earth, followed by a loud whistle and another explosion. This time we felt as if we were being lifted from the ground. We were shaken by a displacement of the air of an astonishing violence. Then an avalanche of stones and chunks of ice poured down on us. We made ourselves as small as we could, not daring to move or speak. We had dropped our guns and our messed ins. "They'll kill me," shouted a young fellow who had hurled himself into my lap in the general confusion. "They're going to kill me." There was another loud boom, and then a deafening German salvo passed over our heads. "Let's go on, we can't stay here," yelled our sergeant, shoving his helmet further down onto his head. We picked up our boxes like automatons. The trench was wide enough for four men to walk abreast, but we proceeded single file, keeping close to one of the walls. I was with Hals, directly behind the sergeant, who kept exhorting us to move. "Hurry up. Quick. The Russians have spotted our battery. They can see it, and we're right beside it. This damned trench is heading right into their fire. We've got to get to that communication trench down there." Every other minute we had to throw ourselves into the bottom of the trench. The heavy cases kept slipping from our icy fingers no matter how tightly we tried to hold them. It still seems astonishing that they didn't explode in our faces. "Hurry up," said the sergeant, disregarding our troubles. "It's down there."
"Tell me," said Hals.
"There's still twice as much as this on the sleighs." "Do we have to bring all that too?"
"Yes, of course."
"I don't know. Hurry up, for God's sake." While the Russians were reloading, our battery had fired twice. The next Russian salvo fell about 40 yards behind us, followed by two others at an indefinable distance, which nonetheless made us double over a little lower. Suddenly there was a deafening hooting sound, followed by an overwhelming noise which shook the earth and the air. One side of the trench collapsed. It all happened so quickly I had no time to duck. I remember seeing what looked like a disintegrating scarecrow flying through the rubble in a cone of flame, and falling in several pieces onto the edge of the trench, before rolling to the bottom. We were all thrown to the ground without the strength or courage to get up again. "Quick! Up! We've got to get to the other trench!" shouted the sergeant, whose face was contorted by fear. "If a shell lands here, it will be a volcano." There were two more explosions. Our guns were firing steadily. Dragging the cases, we climbed across the debris and the body of the poor wretch who had been blown into the air. I glanced at him quickly as we went by. It was a horrible sight. His helmet had fallen down over his face, and its visor was half buried in his chin, or neck. His heavy winter clothes were like a sack holding together something which no longer bore any resemblance to the human form. He was missing a leg, or perhaps it was doubled under him. Another body was mixed into the rubble a short way off. The Russian shell must have landed right on some poor fellows who had ducked their heads and were waiting for the storm to pass. I can remember very distinctly the first deaths I encountered in the war. The thousands upon thousands which followed are blurred and faceless, a vast, cumulative nightmare which still haunts me, in which atrocious mutilations appear side by side with figures who seem to be peacefully sleeping, on with others whose eyes are opened astonishingly wide, stamped by death with an uncommunicable terror. I thought I had already experienced the limits of horror and of endurance, that I was a tough fighting man who would return home in due course to recount my heroic exploits. I have used the words and expressions which my experiences from Minsk to Kharkov to the Don suggested to me. But I should have reserved those words and expressions for what came later, even though they are not strong enough. It is a mistake to use intense words without carefully weighing and measuring them, or they will have already been used when one needs them later. It's a mistake, for instance,
to use the word frightful to describe a few broken-up companions mixed into the ground, but it's a mistake which might be forgiven. I should perhaps end my account here, because my powers are inadequate for what I have to tell. Those who haven't lived through the experience may sympathize as they read, the way one sympathizes with the hero of a novel or a play, but they certainly will never understand, as one cannot understand the unexplainable. This stammering outpouring may be without interest to the sector of the world to which I now belong. However, I shall try to let my memory speak as clearly as possible. I dedicate the remainder of this account to my friends Marius and Jean-Marie Kaiser, who are in a position to understand me, as they lived through the same general events in the same part of the world. I shall try to reach and translate the deepest level of human aberration, which I never could have imagined, which I never would have thought possible, if I hadn't known it firsthand. We reached the communications trench, which had seemed like safety to our sergeant, and literally dived into it as a brutal burst of fire scattered the soil beyond the parapet. The two men in white overalls who were already there jumped up in astonishment. One of them had been standing beside the gun surveying the scene through field glasses. The other, hunched down at the bottom of the hole, had been fiddling with the knobs of a radio apparatus. "The section?" asked our sergeant, puffing for breath. "We've got some supplies for them. It's not very far," said the soldier with the field glasses, "but you won't be able to get there right now. You'd only be blown up. Put your explosives down but not right here and use the bunker." He smiled. Without waiting for him to repeat the invitation, we slid down into a tomb-like structure of boards and hard earth, which was almost without light. Inside, there were four soldiers dressed in white. One of them had somehow managed to go to sleep. The others were writing beside a flickering candle. The bunker wasn't high enough for us to stand, and everyone had to move over so we could get in. But we were, at any rate, something new. "Is it solid?" Hals asked, pointing his tattered finger at the roof of the rat hole. "Well, if something lands a little closer, it might collapse," one of the soldiers answered mockingly. "And if something lands square on us, our pals won't have to bury us," added another. "How could they joke?" "Habit, probably." The fellow who had been asleep woke up and yawned. "I thought they'd sent us some women." "No. Just a bunch of kids." "Where did you find this brood, Sergeant?" We all laughed. As if to rub our noses in our situation, the ground shook again. From here the noise was less violent. "These boys are new recruits, part of the Supply train, and they've crossed the whole of Russia so you can fill your stomachs." "That's nothing," said the fellow who just waked up. "We've been sweating it out here for 3 months already, while you were taking your own sweet time. I know they've got pretty girls in the Ukraine, but you shouldn't have stayed there so long. We've been dying of hunger." I ventured a few words in my atrocious German, "Girls. We didn't see any girls. All we saw was snow." "Alsatian?" somebody asked. "No, he's French," Hals answered, joking. Everyone burst out laughing. Hals was taken aback, and didn't know what to say. "Merci," the questioner added with a good accent, holding out his hand to me. "Ma mère ist Talmand," I replied. "Look, Gott. Worte mutter ist Deutscher, Sir Gott." The ground shook again. Some pieces from the ceiling rattled down onto our helmets. "Things don't seem to be going very well here," said our sergeant, whose mind was absorbed by his terror, and who plainly didn't give a damn whether my mother was German or Chinese. "Oh, they're just having fun," the other one said. "The beating they took 3 days ago really calmed them down." "Ah?" "Yes. Those bastards made us recross the Don about a month ago. We had to give up at least 40 miles. Now our front is on the west bank. They've tried to cross on the ice at least 4 times already. The last time was 5 days ago. Then you would really have seen something. They attacked for 2 days, especially at night. It was really pretty rough. You see how I am today. I'm trying to catch up on my sleep. We haven't had much lately. We're supposed to counterattack too, but nothing's happened yet. Take a look through the glasses. The ice is still covered with Russians. The pigs don't even pick up their wounded. I'll bet some of them down there are still groaning. We're supposed to resupply the section, our wretched sergeant explained anxiously. You'll find them a little further on, right down on the river bank, real daredevils. I think they've got the little island too. They lost it one night when they had to fight hand to hand, but in the morning they took it back. It's a pretty tight spot down there, I can tell you. I'd rather be where I am. Our battery had been silent for a few minutes, but the Russian shells were still coming over at a slow but regular pace. The soldier with the field glasses came in, hunched up and blowing on his fingers. Your turn, he said to one of the soldiers. I'm shaking so hard I'm afraid my teeth will fall out. The man he called got up with a groan, and pushed his way through to the exit. Our guns aren't firing anymore. Have they been destroyed? Our sergeant asked the newcomer. You've got some funny ideas, the soldier replied, still rubbing his fingers. We'd be in a fine fix without them. A few days ago, we'd have just been overrun without those guns. I sincerely hope that our comrades of the 107th are still among the living. I do too, our sergeant agreed emphatically, realizing that he'd said the wrong thing. But why have they stopped firing? You should know how tight supplies are. We have to fire drop by drop, so to speak, or when we know we can't miss. The infantry and the artillery both have to economize on munitions to the maximum. But we can't let the Soviets know that, so from time to time we give them a heavy dose. You see? I see. They're not shooting anymore, said someone in our group. Yes. It's quieted down. You'd better make the most of it, said one of the soldiers from the Jesnos. Let's go, children, said our sergeant, who seemed to have regained some confidence. Children. He wasn't far wrong. We seemed like children beside these Don veterans. A few rounds from the big guns had seemed to us like the end of the world. There was a great difference between the proud soldiers we'd been in Poland, marching smartly through the villages with our guns slung, and what we were now. How many times in the past I had thought myself invulnerable, filled with the pride we all felt, admiring our shoulder straps and helmets and magnificent uniforms and the sound of our footsteps, which I loved, and love still, despite everything. But here, by the banks of the Don, we seemed like nothing, like bundles of rags which each sheltered a small, trembling creature. We were underfed and unbelievably filthy. The immensity of Russia seemed to have absorbed us, and as truck drivers we were not dashing figures, but more like the junior maid servants of the army. We were dying of cold like everybody else, only our plight was never mentioned. We left the shelter timidly, glancing toward the nearby parapet which screened off the war, and picked up our dangerous burdens. Everything seemed to have calmed down. There was no more noise, and the light in the sky had become less brilliant. We took a zigzag line of trenches, which ran parallel to the point we had to reach. Everywhere there were shelters filled with half-frozen soldiers trying to warm themselves beside those miraculous gasoline lamp heaters, and everywhere we were greeted by the same question, any mail? Three Messerschmitts passed overhead, and were greeted by a loud cheer. The confidence which the infantry placed in the Luftwaffe was absolute, and on innumerable occasions the familiar shapes of the planes with the black crosses restored faltering courage and frustrated a Russian attack. Several times, as we moved forward, we had to press ourselves against the side of the trench so that stretcher bearers carrying wounded could get through. We were drawing close to the outermost limit of the German lines. The trenches grew progressively narrower and shallower, so that eventually we became a kind of human chain, bent nearly double in order to remain unseen. Several times, I sneaked to look over the parapet. Some 60 yards ahead, I could see the tall grass on the riverbank, stiff with frost, and somewhere in that space was the section we were supposed to supply. Now we were advancing half-exposed, setting off slides of earth and snow as we jumped from one hole to the next. We clattered down into a huge crater, where an orderly in heavy winter clothes was bandaging two fellows who were clenching their teeth to keep themselves from crying out. He told us we had reached our destination. We wasted no time inspecting the situation of this cursed section, but put our cases in the hole we were shown, and turned back for another trip. By nightfall we had completed what we later learned to call the priority supply of this frontline section. Nothing had happened since the bombardment of the afternoon, and the unfortunate soldiers on the Don were preparing themselves for another icy night. Although the temperature had risen a little, it was still very cold. We were waiting for two of our men who were collecting the scattering of letters these soldiers had managed to write. Hals, another soldier, and I were sitting on a mound of frost-hardened earth, hidden from enemy eyes. "I wonder where we'll be sleeping tonight," said Hals, staring at his boots. "Outdoors, I guess," our companion answered. "I don't see any hotels around here." "Come over this way," called someone else from our group. "You can see the river very well from here." We got up from the ground to look through a heap of frosty branches that camouflaged a Spandau aimed and ready to fire. "Look," Hals said. "Bodies lying on the ice." There were numbers of motionless bodies, victims of the fighting of a few days earlier. The soldiers at the Jesenaus had not been exaggerating, the Russians had not removed their dead. I tried to see further into the distance, to what must be the island we had heard so much about, but this was difficult, as it was growing dark. I could recognize only vaguely what looked like snow-covered trees. Our soldiers must be crouched among them, watching in the silence, with every sense alert. Beyond, in the heavy, unbreathable mist falling across this mournful landscape, the far bank was almost invisible. On this bank, the German advance had been halted, and Russian soldiers were watching for us. I had reached the front line, the line I had thought about with such dread and had been so curious to see. For the moment, nothing was happening. The silence was almost complete, broken only by occasional voices. I thought I could see a few thin streams of smoke rising through the mist on the Russian side. Then some other soldiers pushed me aside. "If it interests you so much," said one of the grenadiers standing at the foot of the Spandau, "I'll gladly give you my place. I've had enough of this cold." We didn't know what to say. His place was certainly not very enviable. A lieutenant in a long hooded coat jumped into our hole. Before we had time to salute, he lifted a pair of field glasses, and stared into the distance. A few seconds later, we heard the sound of heavy detonations coming from behind us. Almost at once, there were explosions on the ice, immediately reproduced by a long, repetitive echo, and then a sharp whistling sound which rang through the air very close to us. The entire German front responded immediately. The noise of the guns became indistinguishable from the explosion of their projectiles. We all dropped to the bottom of the hole. We felt lost, and stared at each other with anguished, questioning eyes. "They're attacking," someone said. The two machine gunners didn't fire right away, but stayed beside the lieutenant, staring at the Don. Some of the explosions were loud and strident, others sounded heavy, and as if they were coming from underground. Finally, the grenadier who had so generously offered his place decided to speak to us. "The ice is breaking more easily tonight. It's not so cold. Pretty soon they'll have to swim over." We all hung on his words, as none of us understood what was happening. "We'll send out the lightest one here," he said. "If the ice holds his weight, we'll have to blow it up." "He's the lightest," said Hals with a constricted laugh, pointing to a cringing, very young soldier. "What will I have to do?" the boy asked, white with anxiety. "Nothing just yet," the gunner said jokingly. "The bombardment stopped as suddenly as it had begun." The lieutenant looked out through his glasses for a few more minutes, then climbed over the parapet and vanished. We stayed where we were, without moving or speaking. To break the anxious silence, our sergeant ordered us to open our mess tins and eat dinner, while we waited for the fellows with the mail. We swallowed down our tasteless, frozen portions without much appetite. As I chewed, I went over to the spandau to look down once more at the river. What I saw explained the German bombardment of a few moments ago. Great blocks of ice, some of them 2 feet thick, were standing up at right angles to the surface of the river. These ice blocks, partly broken and crushed, formed steep hills of ice, whose crests oscillated with the rhythm of the current beneath the frozen surface. The German gunners fired on the ice every night to deny access to the incessant Soviet patrols, who nonetheless exposed themselves to great danger on these moving blocks. Now the broken ice was rearing up and crashing into other pieces with a strange, heavy sound. New fissures were opening, and the night was filled with the noises of cracking, breaking ice. I stood for a long time, transfixed by the unreal vision, gradually noticing that hundreds of lights were springing up on the east bank. With my eye glued to the loophole, I stared at these lights, which seemed to be growing stronger. "Hey," I shouted at the two regulars, "something's happening." They rushed over to me, pushing me aside so they could see. I stayed where I was, shoving my head between theirs. "Hell, you really scared us," one of them said. "That's nothing, they do it every night. The pop-offs like to make us think they're warming up." "Not at all a bad idea, either. Those lights are a damned nuisance. Look how hard it is to see the river now. Even flares make it hard." I couldn't tear myself away from this disquieting vision. All along the vast horizon, the Russians had lit hundreds of braziers, not to warm themselves, because they must certainly have kept their distance from them, but to dazzle our observers. And in fact, when the eye traveled to the east bank, it remained fixed on those fires. Everything else, by contrast, was plunged into darkness, and this enabled the enemy to effect numerous changes which we could deduce only with difficulty. We were able to see a little with flares, but their radiance, although intense, was reduced at least to half strength by the enemy's arrangement of alternating light and darkness. I would have stood and stared much longer if our sergeant hadn't given the signal for departure. We had no trouble returning to the rear. The night, undisturbed by the noises of war, hid our movements perfectly. Everywhere, soldiers were curled up in their holes. Those who were asleep had covered themselves with everything they could find, leaving no fraction of themselves exposed, not a nose, or the tip of an ear. One needed to be accustomed to this strange mode of existence to know that beneath these mounds of cloth, subtle human mechanisms were managing to survive and garner their strength. Others were playing cards in the depths of their lairs, or writing letters in the flickering light of a candle, or of a lamp heater. These marvelous objects, and I call them marvelous deliberately, were about 2 feet high, and would operate on gasoline or kerosene. One simply had to regulate the nozzle and the intake of air. A reflector behind a glass projected the light. A story had it that the army was working on an improved model which would also dispense beer. Those who were neither asleep, on guard, playing cards, or writing letters were absorbing the alcohol which was freely distributed along with our ammunition. "There's as much vodka, schnapps and Tira Clicker on the front as there are packs," I was told later by a wounded infantryman who was waiting for evacuation on the hospital train. "It's the easiest way to make heroes. Vodka purges the brain and expands the strength. I've been doing nothing but drink for 2 days now. It's the best way to forget that I've got 7 pieces of metal in my gut, if you can believe the doctor." We got back to our 2 sleighs without incident. "Am I dreaming?" Hals said, "or has it grown warmer? I'm sweating like an ox in these clothes. Maybe I've got a fever, that's all I need." "Then I've got one too," I said. "I'm soaking wet." "That's because you had the balls scared off you today," said the fellow who earlier in the afternoon had shouted, "They'll kill me." "Listen to who's talking," Hals said. "You're still as green as your clothes, and you think you can judge us?" Our sleighs were now carrying 6 wounded as well as ourselves. Although they were less heavily loaded than they had been, they ran less smoothly. The little horses were clearly having a hard time. We could almost see the snow growing softer as we looked at it. The wind was carrying large flakes of melting snow, which soon changed to rain. This mild air, after such terrible cold, seemed to us like the Côte d'Azur. It took us 2 hours to reach our huts in the rear lines, and we needed no urging to fling ourselves onto our rough pallets. However, despite the physical and emotional exhaustion of that wearing day, I wasn't able to sleep immediately. I kept seeing the banks of the Don, and hearing the whine of enemy projectiles, and the explosions, whose violence I would never have been able to imagine. For me, whose eardrums were shattered by the firing of a Mauser, our Polish exercises now seemed like the most trifling of games. The infantry on the West Bank had to fight as well as survive, that was the difference between them and us. We had been promised that we would be as honored as the infantry, as combat troops, if we distinguished ourselves on our supplely missions. This promise, which had been made to us on behalf of our commander at the Wajin Legion near Minsk, was clearly addressed to young recruits like Hals, Lenson, Olensheim, and me. We had taken it as an honor, and were proud of the confidence which had been placed in us. Yet the reports in the frontline journal blamed us squarely, almost making us responsible for the German retreat from the Caucasus, and back beyond Rostov. For lack of supplies, these troops had been forced to abandon territories won with great sacrifices, so that they would not suffer the same fate as the defenders of Stalingrad. In their exhortations to us, our officers often asked us to achieve a certain goal despite adverse conditions, at whatever the cost, to do more than was humanly possible, to face the prospect of the worst, including death. We had thought that we had accomplished more than the bare minimum. In fact, despite our unstinted efforts, and all our bit moments, we had achieved somewhat less than half of what had been expected. Maybe we should have given our lives too. Absolute sacrifice was what the High Command called it. These words made my head spin, as I stared with wide eyes into the impenetrable darkness, sinking gradually into sleep, as into a large black pit. The march to the rear, from the Don to Kharkov, first spring first retreat, the Donets battle, for 3 or 4 more days, we were involved in occupations of more or less the same kind. The snow was melting everywhere, and the cold was lessening as rapidly as it had increased, which seemed to be the way of Russian seasons. From implacable winter one was shifted into torrid summer, with no spring in between. The thaw did not improve our military situation, but made it worse. The temperature rose from 5 degrees below zero to 40 degrees above, melting the unimaginable ocean of snow which had accumulated all winter. Enormous pools of water and swampy patches appeared everywhere in the partly melted snow. For the Wehrmacht, which had endured the horrors of 5 winter months, this softening of the temperature fell like a blessing from heaven. With or without orders, we took off our filthy overcoats and began the general cleanup. Men plunged naked into the icy waters of these temporary ponds for the sake of a washing to no gunfire disturbed the tranquil air, which was sometimes even sunny. The war itself, whose indefinable presence we still felt, seemed to have grown less savage. I had made the acquaintance of a sympathetic fellow, a non-com in the engineers, whose section was temporarily billeted in the hut opposite ours. He came from Kiel, right across the Rhine from Strasbourg, and knew France better than his own country. He spoke perfect French. My conversations with him, which were always in French, were like rest periods after the painstaking gibberish I was forced into with my other companions. Hals often joined us to improve his French in the same way I tried to improve my German. Ernst Neubuck, my new friend, seemed to be a born engineer. He had no equal in his ability to knock a few old boards into a shelter as weatherproof as one a fully equipped mason might build. He made a shower from the gas tank of a large tractor, and it functioned miraculously, with a lamp heater continuously warming its 40 gallons of water. The first men to use this shower unfortunately received a tepid downpour of water flavored with gasoline. Although we rinsed the tank repeatedly, the water remained tainted for a long time. In the evenings waiting to use the shower, there was always a crowd of shouting, pushing men, which often included our superiors. Priority was awarded to whoever produced the largest number of cigarettes, or a portion of the bread ration. Our Feldwebel, Laus, once paid 300 cigarettes. The showers always began after the 5 o'clock meal and continued late into the night in an atmosphere of rowdy horseplay. Those who got through the showers first often found themselves tossed onto their backsides in the liquid mud which flooded the outskirts of the camp.